Good morning. I'm Penny Eiler, a member of the Program Committee. For today's opening reading, the congregation will join me in the responsive reading of our usual opening statement. Para-Universalist Society aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Our Unitarian faith calls us to recognize that no one is a stranger, to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and to support the use of justice for all people. So welcome. And if you're a visitor, a guest, or a returning friend, later in the service there'll be an opportunity for you to introduce yourselves so we may get to know you better. Here at Prairie, Sunday morning program is kind of like a box of chocolate. You just never know what you're going to get. A presentation by a Prairie member or a future minister. Today we are pleased to welcome a speaker from the wider community, Dr. Myra Marks Ferry. Okay. Please welcome Mary and Patty as they light our chalice, after which we'll have a moment of silent meditation.
I measure the progress of a community by the degree of progress which women have achieved. B.R. Ambedkar.
Today we'd like to welcome Myra Marks Ferry. She was born in 1949 and received her BA from Bryn Mawr College in 1971 and her PhD from Harvard University in 1976. She taught at the University of Connecticut for 24 years, where she became the director of the Women's Studies Program before joining Wisconsin's Department of Sociology in 2000, and in 2001 became a joint governance professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies. In Madison, she is a director of the European Union Center of Excellence, an academic program on European affairs that is part of an elite international network of similar centers funded by the European Union. Her career has emphasized socially engaged research on gender arrangements, feminist politics, and social justice in the United States and Germany, with significant forays into comparative studies of gender politics in other parts of the world. Her newest books, Varieties of Feminism, German Gender Politics and Global Perspectives, is being released in 2012 by Stanford University Press. Her role in the profession has included serving as Vice President of the American Sociological Association, the ASA, President of Sociologists for Women in Society, Deputy Editor of the American Sociological Review, and the Chair of both the Sex and Gender and the Collective Behavior and Social Movement section of the ASA. She has been the recipient of the ASA's Jesse Bernard Prize, recognizing cumulative research contributions in the area of gender, as well as prizes for outstanding books and articles in the comparative politics, social movements, and gender. I'd like to welcome Myra Marks Ferry.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your generosity in inviting me here. It's really an honor to talk to you. And it's been really quite interesting to me to hear and see the various kinds of ethical commands that this congregation embraces, because that's precisely the sort of thing that I want to talk to you today about, the sort of ethical commands and the notion of how to go about doing global feminism. How do we look other women in the eye as equals, learn from them in the richness of their experience? Which, although Penny sort of said, gee, give us some facts here, I think it's really important to emphasize that it's not about collecting facts. It's really about consideration of risks first. And I'm going to give you some concrete examples of facts and experiences, but I'm really going to emphasize the perspectives. And I want to talk about two risks of perspective that come about often when we start collecting facts without thinking through the ethical domain. One is the risk of approaching comparative studies as a tourist, and the other as approaching comparative studies as a missionary. And I'm going to not just draw from my own research, but that from some of my students and colleagues, some of which are included in our book, Global Feminism. In this book, we attempt to reconstruct a history of global feminism from the perspective of those countries of less affluent and privileged global South. We also try to reflect on the problems that we as feminists of the North face in trying to act in solidarity with our sisters elsewhere. So let me begin by considering a few of the tools we need to have to be something more than a tourist or a missionary. First of all, I want to argue that if we look at the other as not a tourist or missionary, we also have to be looking at ourselves. If we fail to think critically about our own relationships to what we are seeing, then we're bracketing our position and perspective, and that's exactly what a tourist does. When we're tourists, we see the other society or practice just as a spectacle for our education or entertainment. We participate in the role of audience or voyeur. The tourist has the liberty to be moved by another's suffering, to react with horror or with admiration, but the feelings are those similar to those evoked by an especially compelling movie or a play. We observe and we evaluate. We use our own standards and perspectives as if they were universal. And we do not observe or evaluate ourselves. If we don't want this tourist role, we need to be self-aware enough to realize that the women that we see are also watching us and evaluating us according to their own perspectives. To create a situation, therefore, of mutual regard, we have to realize that the other person, when they observe us, may feel as much curiosity or dismay as we feel in watching them, or admiration for that matter. So the next step is to actively turn the lens around, to see ourselves in this act of looking, to see ourselves as part of a system that is in fact no less surprising, odd, and in need of explanation as any other. The burqa and the swimsuit?
Yeah.
All right. The process of intentionally making ourselves strange, achieving distance from our own culture's taken for granted assumptions, is often much harder to do than looking at strangers inquisitively, but it's just as essential. As easy as it may be to see other people's lives as strange and other cultures as oppressive, it's hard to see ourselves as doing things that are strange and culturally oppressive. But the tourist mentality may be no more than an emotional trick we play on ourselves to keep from recognizing the common dimensions of an issue, like women's dress. Let me give you another example, clitoridectomy, or as some would say, female genital mutilation. One of my most brilliant students, Lisa Wade, did her dissertation on the US perceptions of such cutting. As she points out, this is not really one procedure. It's really a wide range of possible surgeries, from a small nick to a major cutting and sewing together of women's genitals. But as the term female genital mutilation, or FGM as sometimes is said, as that term implies, our media present it to us as an unjustifiable act of abuse always, and as a typical form of violence against women that is seen as characteristic of cultures in Africa or under Islam. Newspaper and other media accounts stress medically primitive procedures, the most extreme cases, the harms done and have stirred American women to outrage on behalf of the poor African girls undergoing such incomprehensibly cruel genital surgery. But this easy contrast between enlightened, sexually emancipated Western women and the oppressed women subjected to an exotic procedure troubles me. If one looks at genital surgeries only as something that happens to women who are other than us, we become tourists for whom the problem is safely distant, exotic, and inexplicable. How could mothers do this to their daughters, we ask. We hear some women embrace this cutting as part of their culture, other women from this culture reject it as violence and oppression, and we imagine that we ourselves stand in some neutral position from which we can evaluate these two different points of view. And we judge the latter group, those who condemn it, to be the more feminist, more sensible, and not least more like us, since we can't imagine embracing this particular tradition. The culture seems to want women to do something medically dangerous to their own healthy bodies for some reason we cannot seem to grasp. However, if we can put our own relationship to our bodies explicitly into the discussion, our perspectives might change. Lisa Wade also coined the term cultural clitoridectomy to talk about the excision of any mention of the clitoris from high school sex education materials in the United States, and to turn our attention to the anxiety about women's actively seeking sexual pleasure that is expressed in both some Muslim and some Christian communities. Why and how African Muslim mothers are worried about making their daughters marriageable and what they are willing to do to their daughters to make them more marriageable becomes a lot more comprehensible if it is related to how mothers worry about daughters' sexuality and about being marriageable in this culture. How girls in different parts of the world resist efforts to control them sexually and to deny their capacity for sexual pleasure would then become the focus of our discussion rather than the exoticism or supposed exoticism of the surgeries. Next slide. The campaign against FGM was a big success in the US, Lisa argued, because it ignored the way that it resembles the surgeries done on women's bodies here. In the name here, however, of increasing sexual attractiveness and or pleasure. American women spend approximately $15 billion a year on medically unnecessary surgical procedures for cosmetic purposes. Our culture highly values the appearance of youthfulness and nubile availability, as a New Yorker article put it. In this article, from which the cartoon is taken, a Bel Air matron who, having already had liposuction, a tummy tuck, a brow lift, two facelifts, two eye lifts, and two successive sets of breast implants, had recently undergone labiaplasty, an operation to rejuvenate the vagina. So when American women rose up in outrage to prevent a Seattle hospital providing a tiny 2-centimeter nick in the clitoris of Somali immigrant girls to mark their coming of age, arguing that the inherently barbaric and oppressive custom of FGM should never be imported into the United States, they were actually uninterested in how medically safe female circumcision could be made. The Somali women who requested this procedure for their daughters, as well as the doctors who considered their request reasonable, were vilified in the press, and eventually the hospital backed down. Now, don't misunderstand me. I am very much against harmful, disabling, health-impairing forms of female genital cutting, for that matter, female breast cutting. But need all cutting in the genital area, whether done by Bel Air matrons or Somali immigrant women, be legally prohibited in order to protect women? If it is fine to get potentially dangerous breast implants, liposuctions, or labioplasties if you are a white American who can afford them, what is the problem with making female genital cutting a minor, medically safe procedure for immigrants who see that as part of their culture? Or conversely, what is wrong with a culture that accepts and applauds extreme makeover and nip and tuck? It is the supposedly ignorant and backward Somalis who were brave enough to try to confront and change their own culture of modifying women's bodies, not us enlightened Americans. Are we equally willing to discuss banning bikinis as we are banning burkas? Let me turn now to my second principle for engaging with global feminism, namely avoiding the missionary position. I mean the term missionary position not only to refer to a sexual practice, but to the broader range of cultural phenomena where the issue is who's on top. This is not just avoiding a simple-minded pro-Americanism, which I think for many of us is easy. Of course, we do not have the greatest healthcare system in the world by any standard you care to choose, and our literacy rate is actually shameful for a developed country. It's a chore to even begin to list the ways our political system fails women. On average, for example, we pay child care and elder care workers less than parking lot attendants. And the Supreme Court recently affirmed that home care workers are not even covered by minimum wage laws. But even after you admit that the US isn't the model for all other societies, your understanding of other countries can be reduced to a search for example of who is better, who is worse, who is on top. As you begin to see how badly mothers and children are treated in this country, for example, you may find yourself becoming missionaries for the Swedish government or for the European Union. After all, Swedish and German, and now also German parents, get 12 months off work at basically full pay for each child, for one caretaker, increased by an additional 2 months if the other parent also participates, either together or sequentially. All over Europe, the idea of adding such extra daddy months to the already generous paid leaves that employed mothers have long enjoyed is catching on and spreading. Is it going to happen here? No. So it's tempting to use that kind of cross-national data just to establish the better and the worse, to try to put all countries on a single continuum of being more or less good for women. And despite the fact that the United States does not come out as number one in this exercise, being a missionary for Sweden rather than for the United States doesn't let us off the moral hook. Instead, I think it introduces the temptation to erase a historical process of political, economic, social, and cultural struggle. The struggles that made Sweden into Sweden, Norway into Norway, Japan into Japan, the United States into the United States. In the absence of such a systematic analysis of each system, we don't understand why the particular benefits that Swedish women have today couldn't just be picked up and dropped down like manna from heaven on the heads of American women. Similarly, we don't understand why the benefits of being American are not similarly raining down on the women of other parts of the world. If we take the single aspects of other countries' social programs and compare them to the United States, stripped of their contexts in the political struggles of many different groups and interests, we avoid facing the practical political constraints of social change. Class systems and race systems are deeply part of gender systems and vice versa. And some of us, no more than other women around the world, cherish parts of our particular social arrangements for their familiarity, their predictability, and last but not least, for the privileges we have or expect to have from them. Some others among us, like some of them, are eager to see these arrangements vanish in a puff of smoke. But social change is not a matter of waving our hands and wishing we were somewhere else, probably Sweden. We have to try to figure out how to get from where we are now to where we want to go. If we don't take this history of struggle seriously, we're likely to imagine that it would be easy to get from here to some better place. And this leads to the danger of blaming women or feminists for the problems in our political and social system. At the one end, there are those who would blame feminists rather than the economy for making married women need and want to work. At the other end of the political spectrum, we find feminists being blamed for the absence of maternity leave or for decent childcare. Somehow we haven't fought hard enough or cared enough about mothers. If only we tried hard enough. Just for an example, Sylvia Ann Hewlett, as well as some others, enumerate all of the Swedish social benefits for child rearing, and then turn right around and scold US feminists for not demanding and getting the same. It's just as non-productive as our looking at Chilean feminists and scolding them for not having the same access to divorce or contraception that American women have. Comparisons are useful if they create awareness of what you as an American do or don't have, but it's destructive of global feminism if the analysis stops there. Implicitly, the idea is that if you really wanted this social policy, you would have it, and the power relationships vanish. We seem somehow to have failed as individuals or as a movement that we have not ended racism or transformed the United States into an egalitarian society. And as Audre Lorde has argued, this feeling of guilt is paralyzing. An action orientation demands seeing where and how something can be done. Since social policies are not transferred as discrete blessings from above, whether they should come from Sweden to the US or be sent from the US to some other country, realizing that all of these benefits are the outcomes of struggles in particular places and times, it helps to free us from the myth that we have a calling to emancipate other women, be it in Iraq or Afghanistan or China. Our analysis has to go beyond a missionary-like preaching of the virtues of some other heavenly state to begin to understand how gender, race, and class work together to shape our system. So the example I want to turn to now is drawn from my own work on German feminism and how the complexity of systems allows for comparison that doesn't put either side on top. As I was studying German feminism, I was very puzzled by the fact that German feminists don't seem to be bothered by making claims about women that strike me as very essentialist. For example, one feminist demand that was seriously debated in the late 80s and early 1990s was that only women should be entitled to vote on abortion laws. What makes women look like a single group, especially as a special interest group that can be represented or be protected? Parking spot suggests that women might even be protected like the handicapped. This is a women's parking place, a spot near the streetlights where it would be safe to go after dark, or near the cashier in a parking ramp. In the 1980s, German feminists succeeded, as we in the US did not, in getting institutionalized women's affairs offices that would look out for women's interests in the city, state, or federal government. And this was one of the policies that these women's affairs offices promoted. Now, finding this approach strange, I didn't want to stop at thinking that it was merely exotic or peculiar, like a tourist. So I asked what made this sort of group advocacy and group protection strategy so much more plausible in the German context than the American one. And what I found was that the cultural vocabulary of feminism in Germany is quite different than that of the United States. American feminists think of gender as being somehow naturally like race, and German feminists tend to see gender as somehow naturally like class. For American feminists, thinking of gender as being like race means worrying about stereotypes and discrimination, thinking about the individual as being harmed by being considered in terms of the group. In an American context, it seems self-evident that there is a relationship between the kinds of exclusions and oppressions that are organized by the concept of race and those of gender. And there are laws, ranging from the Civil Rights Act to the present, and the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Act, and strategies like the EEOC, and social movements that are common to both race and gender struggles for equal rights. But unlike Americans, German feminists talk about gender in relationship to class. Gender seen through this lens of class is not so much about prejudice and discrimination as it is about the lack of control over the means of production or the means of reproduction. The most important remedy for an absence of control is to seek group representation in the political process, as the socialists did for the working class, and feminists did and should do for women. Not only advocacy, but also protection, therefore makes sense for women, as well as for working class people in general. A good state is one that will protect workers from exploitation by ensuring their rights to act collectively, guaranteeing a living wage, and protecting them from financial misfortune in the case of illness, age, or loss of a breadwinner, which the German state has done since the 1880s. So for German feminists, it's obvious that a good state will do what it can to protect women from sexual assault, to offer financial support to cushion the costs of child rearing, and act responsively to demands that women make as a group, even if it's for a woman's parking place. This is not about essentialism in the American sense, and it works in certain ways to get German, and the same analysis also applies in Sweden, to get women family benefits much more extensive than American women hope to see. Since generous parental leave sounds like nirvana to Americans, the temptation to be a missionary can be great. But if you talk to Swedish and German feminists, they don't think they're so well off. They point instead to the fact that that US women have the protection of the Civil Rights Act, and that discrimination against women is clearly illegal, even though still around. Sex discrimination, while overt in Germany, is much more overt in Germany, where job applicants are routinely expected to provide not only their birth dates, but their marital status, and even their photos with their job applications. Laws against sex discrimination, any kind of law against sex discrimination is new to Germany in just the past few years. And they're still openly ignored. The sign that was prominently displayed in a central Berlin train station basically says, "We want help wanted male," and gives a rate of pay. And this train station is two blocks from the federal parliament. So there's a law against discrimination, see if we care. German feminists wish they had the strong, broad anti-discrimination laws that the US does, even if all they do is push discriminatory behavior underground. And they greatly envy our ability to bring class action suits to make anti-discrimination law enforceable. Unfortunately, that's a right that the Supreme Court is working on dismantling from Walmart on. We have a system, or had a system, that prioritizes allowing individual women who wish to make atypical choices the freedom to do so. Germany and Sweden have a system that supports women who make the typical choice to have a child, then, however, makes it almost impossible to combine that with a full-time job, let alone a challenging career. Mothers and potential mothers get discriminated against because they are expected to take years out of the labor force. So, for example, women make up 45% of the college and university faculty in the United States, but only 10% of the German faculty ranks. In short, each system is a system, and American women can't be expected to see gender through the lens of class any more than German women as a whole could be expected to see gender through the lens of race. Each country has its own history, and its policy strengths and weaknesses reflect this history. Now, that does not mean that I am encouraging you to give up the struggle for paid maternity leave in the United States any more than I encourage German feminists to give up on trying to get stronger and more enforceable anti-discrimination laws. But I do think that we all have to begin from where we are. This is what I argue in more detail in my new book, Varieties of Feminism. And it's the final message that I want to leave you with. That is to say, when we look at comparative statistics, we need to look at them not as tourists and see the exotic, not as missionaries and see what we expect to bring or to have brought to us as manna from above, but see the challenges of struggle that exist in the very particular social and political contexts that we inhabit. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions, and I also do have some flyers for the book out on the table. If anybody wants to go into any of this sort of thing in much greater depth, I recommend the book.
Who gets it?
I have nothing against people fighting it, and I'm not saying that I am for female genital mutilation. I am simply saying that it's easy for us to make an alliance with those who are against it. It's difficult and challenging for us to make an alliance, for example, with the less educated Somali immigrant women who nonetheless are struggling for a kind of change. And no, they're not willing to say, we're going to break with culture, we're going to go do something totally different, but they go from a situation of a major surgery on their daughters to a 2-centimeter nick so that they can preserve the symbol of circumcision as a coming of age ritual. And yet the approach to it is to say, oh, but that would sanctify the oppression of women in the United States or in Germany. And so there is this notion that their culture can't change the way that they might want to change it. We know better how to change it. And that's the only point that I wanted to make. Not that it shouldn't change, and not that I don't applaud efforts to change it. I also applaud efforts in the United States to challenge and change some of the norms about women's bodies that we have here. What I mean by essentialism is simply the idea that there is some essence of womanhood or femininity and some essence of masculinity that people express in perhaps in different ways, but that fundamentally creates women as a group. And women are a group and men are a group, and we can talk about, you know, what advantages women as a group versus men as a group, and what is good for women as a group. And the problems that many of us have with essentialism is the idea that, first of all, the groupness of women is something that was laboriously constructed and is constantly constructed because, of course, while we are women, we are also many other things. We are Madisonians, we are white, we are of a certain age, we are of a certain set of religious commitments, we are richer or poorer or this or that or what have you. And we pick out from these various things that could describe us those things that we consider important for some reason. And there's been a lot of emphasis on the notion that a group called women and a group called men is not something that just essentially exists. It's something that has to be produced politically by, like, speaking to women as women, by speaking to people as feminists, as concerned about issues of reproduction, issues of freedom. And I'll just give you an example of this quote-unquote essentialism. In the United States, there's a broad coalition against abortion rights, which includes both women and men, and a broad coalition for abortion rights, which includes both women and men. And the key issue that divides these two constituencies are ideas of choice and privacy. And abortion is seen as something that really has more to do with family privacy and the sacredness of the individual conscience. In Germany, there are huge differences in opinion between women and men. Abortion is seen as a woman's issue. Women are seen as the ones best able to make decisions about it, and even though it never went so far as saying only women could vote on this, because women are all essentially concerned about abortion and men are essentially not, the idea of this is really a women's issue, this is essential to women, and it's irrelevant to men, was reflected in all of the political parties, even the Christian conservatives, having basically only women in parliament, only the women representatives in parliament, speaking on the bill. Because for men to speak on it, or, you know, it was like 85% women. The men who spoke were like, what are they doing talking about this? This is none of their business. And we just don't see it that way. We don't essentialize women and men as two kind of basically different groups, but we do construct some notion of women and men along with age, along with race, along with sexuality, along with a lot of other things. And we often refer to that within sociology and feminist studies in general as intersectionality. That is to say, there's a lot of stuff going on and we're located at those intersections. And what it means, say, to be a young, poor, divorced white woman with three kids is very different than what it means to be Callista Gingrich. Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And that's what I was trying to emphasize in saying that the issue here is one of struggle, that struggle is the commonality, but you're struggling in a particular system. And the piece that I cut from this to be a little bit shorter is the part about basically trust the locals. And there are a lot of good examples in global feminism of how things can go wrong if in a struggle you think that you come in and you really understand what it is that people need and you don't trust the locals. So that's the next piece sometimes. I don't disagree, and at the same time, I think the issue of male circumcision brings home very carefully how much we need to think about the role of tradition and symbolism. I mean, after all, Jewish circumcision is extremely important to that culture and tradition. And why would we say, oh yes, well, there's an exception, that's a culture and tradition we need to honor and respect, but Somali tradition is not one that we need to honor and respect. And you know, so there's this yes and no, and people need to think this through for themselves, and we need to think through ourselves what are the positions in these kinds of struggles. And that's especially true when we start thinking about quote-unquote men's lib. What is gender transformation from men's perspective? And is it the kind of thing that you're talking about, which I would say is really looking very uncritically at a consumer culture and not really turning the lens on ourselves and saying, what is it about our culture that is oppressive to women and potentially to men, but really just saying, oh, the good thing about our culture is that we insist on a fundamental human equality, which we do. We're not women or men. We say that, at least. We don't necessarily realize it in so many different ways, but we do talk about this women and men, right? We're not essentially different. We're not essentially higher or lower. We say the same thing about race. Unlike the Germans, we don't have quite as much problem with thinking about our society as a fundamentally multicultural one, some of us more than others. But I mean, Germans are really, their heads are hurting at the idea of multiculturalism and diversity. It's changing, but I mean, it's a real struggle for them in a way that it was a struggle for many of us in the 1950s, and it is still a problem. And you know, so the struggles are different, right? And that's really one of the things I just want to emphasize, that we shouldn't overlook places where we have strong things in our tradition that we can call upon as advantages for ourselves in our struggle. In other words, not stand there and say, oh yeah, it's terrific we outlawed discrimination, but rather say, well, what's this principle of outlawing discrimination and how come we haven't used that and pushed that and really made more of that? It's an attempt to do two things. One is to guard women's sexuality, which culturally got elaborated in some ways that were dangerous and bad to women, as if we don't do some things to guard women's sexuality that are bad for women. And the other is the coming of age part, which is the part that the Somalis really wanted to emphasize. Both boys, and they said, and girls should undergo a circumcision at around age 13. It's the appropriate coming of age kind of ritual. And that's what we Americans stopped in Seattle at Harborview Hospital. If anybody wants to read that story in more detail, it's in the journal Social Problems. And if you have access to the university library. And I think the point that you make about it being a mutual learning experience is the key.
Medjid is going to share the closing words with us. All women's issues are to some degree men's issues, and all men's issues are to some degree women's issues, because when either sex wins unilaterally, both sexes lose. Warren Farrell. Thank you for coming, and please extend the hand of friendship to those around you. And then join us for coffee and conversation.